As the new President Pro Tem of the U.S. Senate, Chuck Grassley is third in line of presidential succession. This hour, what does the President of the Senate do? Edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, presidential historian Tim Walch on Grassley's new role. Then, IPR's Katarina Sestarek with this week's action in the Iowa legislature. Why the University of Iowa canceled a white privilege workshop. We'll find out what it's like to be in the U.S. House chamber during the State of the Union address. And, oh joy, Blank Park Zoo's female eastern black rhino is pregnant again. Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this week. We have about a half dozen conversations, topics this hour. Well, in his new position as President pro tempore of the U.S. Senate, Chuck Grassley is third in line of presidential succession. Here's Senator Grassley being sworn in by Vice President Mike Pence as President pro tem of the Senate back in January.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which you are about to enter, so help you God?
I do.
Congratulations.
Applause for Chuck Grassley in the U.S. Senate being sworn in as President pro tem of the U.S. Senate. Tim Walch joins us now, presidential historian, familiar to our listeners, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Ben.
Just into the afternoon, unless you're in a different time zone.
the vestiges of a cold have kept me home. And so
I'm sorry.
At the clock.
No, well,
that's quite all right.
I wish you well getting over that cold.
You bet.
Tell us the role that Chuck Grassley just assumed, President pro tem.
You bet. And, of course, it's one of the constitutionally mandated offices. You know, the Constitution has evolved over the years, but Article 1, Section 3 in the Constitution specifies that in addition to the president of the Senate, who is the vice president of the United States, the Senate will appoint a president pro tempore, meaning, in effect, temporary president, to serve in the absence of the vice president. For folks who've watched C-SPAN or have seen pictures of the Senate, the floor of the Senate, and they've seen people speaking from a rostrum and with individuals behind them, they'll notice there's a dais with an individual standing right kind of in front of the flag. And it won't always be Senator Grassley, because they can appoint, and in fact, Senator Grassley will appoint, acting presidents pro tempore, who are usually junior senators from the ranks of the majority party, from the Republican Party, to, in effect, gain some experience in parliamentary procedure. So although the office has a terrific title and he's sworn to defend the Constitution, and when he is president, as Senator Grassley normally is anyway, he will occupy the chair. And his responsibility, assuming the vice president is not there, of course, he's now in charge of basically being the umpire for the Senate. He decides on parliamentary procedure and rules of order and things along those lines. There's not a lot of real power associated with this office, but it's a way to, and we now recognize the majority party appoints the most senior senator from their party as the president pro tempore. And with the retirement of Orrin Hatch in 2018, Chuck Grassley is the longest-serving Republican senator and is now president pro tempore.
Okay, you mentioned parliamentary procedure. Let's hear some audio
of parliamentary procedure. These are some of the first actions by Senator Grassley in his President of the Senate role from back in January, and maybe after we hear a few seconds. Actually, we won't want to hear more than a few seconds. We'll have you ask you what's going on here.
This is okay.
From January, and you'll hear also Mitch McConnell here, Majority Leader.
Majority Leader.
I ask unanimous consent the Senate proceed to the consideration of S-Res 4 submitted earlier today.
The clerk will report.
Senate Resolution 4, notifying the President of the United States of the election of a president pro tempore.
Is there objection to proceeding to the measure? Without objection, the Senate will proceed.
I ask unanimous consent the resolution be agreed to, the motion to reconsider be considered made and laid upon the table with no intervening action or debate.
Without objection.
I ask unanimous consent the Senate proceed to the consideration of SRS 5.
Okay, so Tim, this is the part of the Senate action that doesn't make our news.
Right. It formalized the selection of Senator Grassley. He in effect approved the resolution. He allowed the resolution to go forward. The Senate Majority Leader asked permission to allow the resolution to go forward. The Senate Majority, he agreed. The Senate Majority Leader put the resolution before the entire Senate and asked unanimous consent, which of course there was. No one's going to pick a fight with Senator Grassley or Senator McConnell. And it's as they say, pro forma. And so that may have been about the easiest resolution the Senate passed, I think, on January 3rd or right around that time when he became the 91st Senate pro tempore, president pro tempore. As far as I know, the only one from Iowa. I have not gone back. It's not an office that gets a lot of attention. I don't think people are writing doctoral dissertations about the power and influence of presidents pro tempore, although it can, in odd circumstances, be an office of some consequence. People should keep in mind the president pro tempore is fourth in line to the presidency. If something were to happen, God forbid, to the vice president and the Speaker of the House, the president pro tempore is next in line to be president. And back in the 19th century, when Andrew Johnson was, of course, impeached and was on trial for high crimes and misdemeanors, there was no vice president. And the president pro tempore, Senator Benjamin Wade, a real radical, would have become president of the United States if Johnson had been impeached. So it can in certain unusual circumstances. But in most cases, it's an honor. It's given to an older senator who probably is serving out his last term. In some cases, like Carl Hayden and Strom Thurmond, they were largely inactive, although they were still the elected senators and still the president's pro tempore. And I think in the case of Carl Hayden, they had to appoint a permanent acting president pro tempore to fill the chair because Hayden wasn't there much. So it can be a somewhat awkward situation, but it's called for in the Constitution.
Okay, Tim, we have about 3 minutes left here. I wanted to, while I have you as and your expertise as a presidential historian, we had a historic State of the Union address on Tuesday, Donald Trump's second, his first with a divided government. He was guest of the U.S. House under Democratic Speaker Nancy Pelosi. What did you find most interesting as a presidential historian watching this?
I think the most important thing are the optics, and that's why the president was very wise to wait until he received the invitation from the Speaker. There were a number of different optics that were important. First of all, of course, the procession of the president to the well where he spoke to the assembled legislators on both sides and both houses, also the Supreme Court, also the Joint Chiefs. So you got a sense of the entire government together. And if there's any power a president has, it's the bully pulpit. The other optic I thought that was important was, in fact, the women in white, who, of course, showed visually how many women, mainly Democrats, but how many women were elected in this recent election. So there was a wave there. And, of course, the president saluted them, I think, inadvertently acknowledging his own election loss in 2018. But that having been said, the problem with most State of the Union speeches is they're too long. They're often filled with a lot of little factoids, and now, of course, we introduce lots of people. The president's trying to make points, lots of people in the gallery, so that very little is memorable. We can go back. There are a few that are important, one of which, of course, is Franklin Roosevelt talking about the four freedoms during World War II. Another is Lyndon Johnson talking about the Great Society. But generally speaking, inaugural addresses are considered of greater importance to historians than those individual State of the Union speeches. And keep in mind, they weren't delivered to the Senate, to the Congress in person until, they were very shortly in the early days. But from Thomas Jefferson to Woodrow Wilson, they were just sent in written form and read by a clerk. Mm-hmm. So it was a requirement of the office, but no one thought, well, we'll turn this into a big event. Since 1913, it's become a bigger and bigger event, but, you know, we've pretty much forgotten it at this point now.
Okay, Tim Walch, thank you for your observations. Yeah. History this week on the President Pro Tem of the Senate, Chuck Grassley actually being sworn in last month, and your observations about the State of the Union address by the president this week. Tim Walch, presidential historian, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. You take care of that cold, Tim.
Yeah. I will. Got to stop smoking those Pall Malls. You know?
Oh, I don't believe that for a minute.
No. Anyway, yeah, this is the winter of our discontent, isn't it? Or at least
take care, Tim.
You bet. Take care. Bye, Ben.
Bye.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Quick conversations on this Friday to end the week. Well, let's stay in the realm of politics to do a quick check of goings-on at the Iowa legislature. Joining us to do that, Katerina Sestarek, IPR Statehouse reporter. Hi, Katerina.
Hi, Ben.
Let's run through a list of things that you've been covering. Very interesting goings-on. Possible changes to the judicial nomination process for our state's high court.
Yes, and for all the courts in the state, actually. So there's a Republican proposal. It passed the first legislative hurdle in both the House and the Senate this week, and it would essentially change the makeup of these nominating commissions that recommend names to the governor, who then appoints judges and Supreme Court justices in the state. And so Republicans are saying that their motivation for doing that is that they think the changes would bring more accountability to voters into the system. But a reminder that we already do have the option of retention elections, so voters can remove judges if they have issues with them, if they know that there are decisions that they don't like. There is that option currently. But Republican lawmakers say this will increase accountability and lead to what they say will be possibly more high-quality judges and justices in the courts.
Right. And Democrats in the minority in both chambers are against this.
Yes, because people who are against this, Democrats, some lawyers, some other groups, they're saying that, you know, we have a merit-based system. It's not very political, although some Republicans and others will disagree that the current system is, they'll say that it is political. But nationwide, Iowa has a good reputation for its merit-based judiciary, and Democrats worry that this will change that for the worse.
Katerina, Republicans also active in the legislature trying to restrict abortion rights. What's going on there?
Right. It's a direct response to an Iowa Supreme Court decision from last year that ruled there is a fundamental right to abortion in the Iowa Constitution, and that gives abortion rights stronger protections at the state level than at the federal level. So this amendment would say the Iowa Constitution does not secure or protect a right to abortion. And so there's a lot of anger and frustration from some of these anti-abortion rights advocates who finally got the legislation that they wanted in the state, but then they see now the courts as holding them back from getting the policies that they want through. And so this constitutional amendment would make it so that judges in the state would have to defer to the U.S. Constitution when they're considering abortion cases.
Mm-hmm. And very interesting also when we look, when we defer then to the U.S., the federal ruling on this in the Supreme Court, of course, with the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, abortion rights activists see that Roe v. Wade landmark decision from 1973 very much in peril. So this is an important development in the Iowa legislature. Let's talk about a sexual harassment settlement. We learned this week that Iowa, I guess that's we, the taxpayers, will pay over $4 million in a sexual harassment settlement.
Yes, this has to do with the Iowa Finance Authority. Nearly a year ago now, Governor Reynolds fired Dave Jamieson, who was the former director of the Iowa Finance Authority, after she received complaints from two women that he had been sexually harassing them. And Jamieson had also been a good friend of Governor Reynolds for a long time. And now the state is settling with these two women for over $4 million total. There hadn't even been lawsuits filed. Both women had filed complaints with the Iowa Civil Rights Commission, and the state settled with them right out of that. And so it avoids lawsuits and it avoids trials and any details that might have come out in those court settings.
Mm-hmm. So no wrongdoing admitted in this settlement, right?
Correct. And now the Iowa Finance Authority is saying that it'll pay back the state for the settlements out of funds that don't come from taxpayer dollars. Mm. But Democratic auditor Rob Sand really questions that and says that it's all taxpayer dollars.
Mm. Okay. Let's talk about something we'll talk about in detail on Monday, our legislative Monday, when you and I host River to River together, Katarina. Let's talk about education for K through 12, a funding increase recommended by a panel in the legislature.
Yeah, so Republican leaders have in the state house have worked out an education funding deal. It would increase base education funding by about $76.8 million. And then it would also add in a few million for transportation and per pupil funding equity issues. So there's just kind of some historical inequities in the system, and they're trying to start solving some of those with some additional funding. That would bring the total of additional education funding up to nearly $90 million.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see, too, also on our Monday program, we'll hear directly from Governor Reynolds, because I guess she asked for more than this Republican panel actually delivered in this plan. So we'll see what her reaction is. Sports betting. We talked about that on Monday, on our legislative Monday, this past Monday. Any movement on sports betting this week since we discussed it?
So a House and Senate panel heard from a bunch of stakeholders. They held some really long hearings, and now they didn't really move forward with anything, because now they will take on the task of forming a final piece of legislation that would then move through the system.
Okay. Katarina Sustarek, IPR State House reporter. Katarina, looking forward to Monday when we talk about K through 12 education here in the state. Thanks.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The University of Iowa has canceled a white privilege workshop set for this month. Joining us to talk about it, Vanessa Miller is Gazette reporter covering higher education. Welcome back to the program, Vanessa.
Yeah, thank you.
So tell us, what is this workshop? What was the purpose of it? I see exploring white identity and understanding your whiteness, some of the titles for these workshops.
Yeah, these were kind of a series of workshops that the university started offering back in 2017, and then we're continuing to offer this year. It kind of came following the presidential election, and there were a lot of sort of racial tensions, and I think there were requests from among the faculty and staff for some sort of training about how to be more sensitive on these subjects. But last year in 2017, 2018, some sort of right-wing publications got word of this and started reporting on it a little bit. Some Iowa lawmakers ended up seeing those stories and hearing those reports and so contacted the University of Iowa with concerns that that maybe this wasn't what they should be using their resources for. They had called a meeting with the University of Iowa to discuss this, and I think that meeting actually got canceled due to weather, as many things have been. But the university decided to sort of proactively end that workshop and go back to the drawing board about what it should look like. I mean, one of the things that they were really concerned about primarily was the title of it, just calling it a white privilege, sort of understanding your whiteness, that kind of title they felt like could have been better selected. So I think they're looking at reframing it and maybe going to offer something again.
But the well-meaning intention behind such workshops is that, you know, you or I or other people born with lighter skin, that we don't really get it. We might understand it intellectually when we read about it in the news, but we don't really get it what it's like to be in our culture some of the time with a darker skin, right? So that's the intention. And so some of the workshop, what happens during the workshop is what? To impress that upon people.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that they go through and try to talk, highlight some issues that people deal with every day who are Black, and maybe we don't understand what they're going through. And then they break up into small groups and ask different questions, including like, how can I better spend my white privilege, or how can I be an ally, that sort of thing. But it's intended to give people a better view of what it's like, you know, as a minority on campus.
Mm-hmm. So what's their future for these workshops? Do we know yet, or is it just being recalibrated, thought over again?
Yeah, I mean, the university is just saying that it's being recalibrated, as you say, and they have not come back with an alternative. But they say that they will. They say that they want to, and they believe it's still an important conversation to have, and that faculty and staff again had requested it. So I think they're hoping to come back with something, but haven't yet.
Mm-hmm. And we should mention, as you do in your article, that the University of Iowa is certainly not alone in having these types of workshops, which we find across the country.
Right. Coe College held a really big one recently that you had to pay to attend. And so, yeah, like you say, not just down university campuses, but in businesses across the country hold things like this all the time.
Vanessa Miller, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about this interesting lawsuit against the University of Iowa, this faith-based student group suing the UI for stripping its campus affiliation. We had some news about that this week. Tell us quickly before we say goodbye for today.
Yeah, a judge came out and ruled in favor of Blink, essentially the Business Leaders in Christ group, saying that they should get permanent status on the University of Iowa campus. But it came with a caveat that would be the case as long as the university continues to employ its human resources policy sort of unevenly. So they still do allow different groups like the veterans group to say you have to have a military tie, you know, to be in our group. So as long as they keep saying that some groups can decide membership based on a protected status, they have to allow Blink to do the same, even if it means that they aren't allowing openly gay members to become leaders, which is what prompted the lawsuit originally.
Mm-hmm. So what are any wider implications in this district court judge with this ruling?
You know, it's funny. The judge actually noted in her ruling that people will try to expand this into this larger issue of, you know, First Amendment versus religious freedom, and that they shouldn't. She noted in their case that this was a really close call, that both sides had some valid points. She actually praised the university's human rights policy as being something it should maintain, but kind of urged it to maintain it in a more even-handed way. So I don't know how broad the implications will be, but we do obviously know that a second student group, InterVarsity Graduate Christian Fellowship, has sued the university as well, and that case is still scheduled for trial and has not had a ruling come down in it. So I'm guessing that this will affect that case, or that the judge will rule similarly in that case, but I guess we'll have to see.
Right, and we'll make sure to check back with you, Vanessa Miller of the Gazette, reporting on higher education. Thank you so much for the update.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Coming up after a short break, I'll talk with the executive director of NAMI Iowa. She'll tell us about being a guest in the U.S. House chambers during the State of the Union address this week. Also, oh joy, Blank Park Zoo has some great information, a great bit of news. A baby black rhino is on the way. We'll hear about it when we come back. Also, Tony Daner about the newly announced lineup for this year's Hinterland Music Festival. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River after a short break.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a workplace community of remote workers, freelancers, and entrepreneurs. Gravitate provides all the space and amenities necessary so you can focus on your work, creativity, and growth. With locations in Des Moines and Valley Junction, learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a moment, details on the joyous news. Perhaps you heard it. The Blank Park Zoo's female eastern black rhino is pregnant again. That's an endangered species. We'll hear about that rhino pregnancy in just a few minutes. But first, if you listen to my conversation with Congresswoman Cindy Axne on Tuesday, you may remember me asking her about the guest she planned to bring along to be with her in the U.S. House chamber for the President's State of the Union address. Well, that guest was Peggy Huppert, Executive Director of NAMI Iowa, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Iowa. Peggy Huppert joins me now. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Ben.
You wrote about the experience of going to Washington in an opinion piece this week in the Des Moines Register. You pointed out in that piece that you've been to Washington dozens of times for work and family trips. But when you made it known on social media that you would be attending the State of the Union for the first time, the address actually in the chamber, you got, would it be fair to say, some pushback from people you connect with on social media?
Yes, that would be fair to say. I definitely did get pushback. You know, why would you want to waste your time to go do that was the general theme.
Mm-hmm. And what was your answer?
My answer was, I want to experience it, and I may not particularly like or even respect the current occupant of the White House, but I respect the office, and I respect the custom and the tradition of the State of the Union, and I was honored to be invited to be the guest of our new Congresswoman, and I wanted to support her and to experience the event for myself. I consider it to be... for me, I'm sure, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
You said one of the highlights was the reception put on by the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, that you were warmly welcomed and people were very interested in hearing that you were from NAMI, Iowa.
That is true. I was introduced to dozens of members of the House, a lot of them, especially a lot of the new female members, because those are, the people that Cindy has gotten to know first and really kind of bonded with, you know, her fellow freshmen. And it was so neat to meet people who I'd seen on television and I'd read about and heard about from all across the country. Cindy always mentioned that I was executive director of NAMI Iowa and I worked on mental health advocacy. And I got a lot of interest and respect for the position, which was terrific. I also heard a lot of stories of members and guests who have their own mental health story in their family or among friends, and also who have been involved with NAMI in some way.
Right.
That was really cool to hear.
Right, and an indication that the taboo about talking about mental health or mental illness is fading.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, one member told me a brief story, and then she said, you know, even 5 years ago, I really doubt I would have shared this at this particular event for sure, but things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with her, and I'm very happy to see that.
Okay, let's go into the U.S. House chamber on Tuesday night. You wrote that you were very close to the, physically very close to the president's family and guests in the U.S. House chamber. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Right. Well, I was kind of in the corner behind the speakers, and so I was just kitty corner from the president's family and guests. I was very close. So we could see them. The first person I actually noticed before most of his family came in was Buzz Aldrin, the astronaut. And I said to the guest sitting next to me, I said, isn't that Buzz Aldrin, the astronaut? And she said, oh, I think you're right. So that kind of began we were looking for kind of famous people or people who we knew. And then, of course, when the Trump family entered, we knew that was an important section. We had seen the World War II veterans out in the hallway being greeted and being getting situated into the area. So we had a clue that was where the kind of the VIP guests were.
Mm-hmm. Did you find it, Peggy, there being live, a moving experience? Were you proud? What was the feeling that you had experiencing it firsthand in the U.S. House chamber?
It was definitely a different experience, especially since we couldn't see the speakers. We were looking at a television monitor, but what we could see is the members and their faces and what they were doing. They were talking to each other. We had a CNN camera right in front of us, so we could see what they were picking out and choosing to focus on. And there were some very spontaneous moments of various emotions. And I was kind of actually, I guess I've watched it on television many, many times, but I've never picked up on the really true raw emotion that's in the room among the members. Mm-hmm. And certainly we saw the guests were, I think, a little bit more restrained because the guests felt, you know, the need to be polite. but there was definitely a lot of emotion on the floor by members of Congress.
Peggy Huppert is with me, executive director of NAMI Iowa. She was a guest of Congresswoman Cindy Axne on Tuesday at the State of the Union in the U.S. House chamber. Quickly, before we say goodbye, Peggy, let's talk a little bit about our state's dealing with mental health issues. In this legislative session, what would you like to see as far as mental health laws in this year's session?
I want to see the establishment of a children's mental health system at long last. We're one of only four states that does not have that. It's high time that we have it, and we've got to stop squabbling about the details of how to implement it and just do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually have a meeting. I'm on the Children's System Mental Health Board, the statewide board. We have a meeting this morning. We have a meeting with the governor's office next week to go over her bill. So I'm hopeful that we're very close and that all of us can work together and make sure that this happens. We also want to see a solution to the funding for the adult mental health system. They passed a great bill last session, a policy bill.
Right.
Putting in place a lot of new programs and services, and those things are being done. They're starting. But the system, which is based on the property tax, the mental health property tax levy, really needs some attention and work, because if nothing is done in a few years, most of the regions are not going to be able to fully fund their services, and it's a bit of a mess right now. So those two things, and then we're also going to be trying to continually improve Medicaid, because so many Iowans, both adults and children with serious mental illness, depend on Medicaid to pay for their services. So, mm-hmm. Those are our priorities.
When you mentioned the 2018 legislative session's work, this mental health care overhaul, can you say yet whether people, families, patients, providers are feeling the impact of that yet?
I'm not sure about yet. I know that several regions are very close to opening access centers, and that was kind of the first round that we saw coming online. And, you know, that's to serve people in crisis. I think that within a year, we're going to see at least three or four of them open, and hopefully we'll start to see positive impacts from that. I know that they're also working on establishing more ACT teams, which is a multidisciplinary team that helps people stay in their community through a lot of services and the intensive residential services. Already, actually, some emergency services have been, crisis services have been added because they're now required across the state. So there's a lot of progress being made.
Peggy Huppert, Executive Director of NAMI Iowa, thank you very much for taking time from your busy day to speak with us.
Thanks for having me, Ben. And I just have to put in a plug for two cultural events
which also show that things have changed around the mental health discussion. We attended Dear Evan Hansen last night at the Civic Center, and it's a very incredible, not only is it a great work of art, but it's a real statement about mental health and mental health conditions among adolescents and how families deal with it. But then also there's a terrific exhibit at the Science Center of Iowa called Mind Matters, and it's going to be there for 3 months, and it's all about mental health and having that experience. So two major things are happening the same week in Iowa that are really a big deal.
Thank you. Executive Director of NAMI Iowa, Peggy Huppert.
Thank you.
Quick conversations to end the week on this edition of River to River. It's a News Buzz edition. A second rhino baby is on the way, we learned this week, at the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. It's a rare eastern black rhino species. Joining us to talk about it, Shalini Babu is an animal keeper at Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. Hi, Shalini.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. So this is great news. How long have you known, and this has been a secret until this last week?
Yes, to the public. I do have the honor of working with these guys, so we did find out a little more than a year ago that she was pregnant, and we kind of shared the news with everyone as soon as we kind of knew that everything was going pretty well, so we're all very, very excited.
Did you say a little more than a year ago you found out that this is a very long gestation period?
Yes. A gestation period is about 14 to 16 months.
Mm.
So it's a lot of time cooking for that little cutie.
Okay, so tell us, who are the lucky mother and father?
The mom is the wonderful Ayana, and the dad is Keanu. And they both are parents of Tumani that we have here at the zoo. And they're going to be great parents again to this new one coming.
Right. Tumani is the older sibling now, soon to be older sibling, the baby girl, I think born in 2016. How is the mother doing? How is Ayana doing? I mean, how do you tell how she's doing? What is a medical examination for a mother rhino?
Yeah, so Ayana is doing very, very well. I think she's kind of she's kind of familiar with it. She already went through it once. As keepers, you know, we are around these animals every day and all day, so any slight behavioral change we'll notice. But so far, she's been doing really well. I mean, her belly is getting pretty big. Her weight has significantly increased as well. She's about 1,235 kgs. And
kigs?
She's been, oh, yeah, kgs. Yeah, so a little more than double for pounds.
Oh, so kilos. So this is,
yes,
like she's over 2,000 pounds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She's hitting the 2,500-pound range.
Okay. And can you actually sometimes, as you see with a human mother, can you see the baby moving at all in her abdomen?
Yeah, so we were kind of lucky. It's kind of a hit or miss. We won't really see it every day, but sometimes in the afternoons and stuff, we'll kind of be staring or watching for it, and you'll definitely see some kicks, which is super exciting for us and almost a little rare, too, because she's not, or he or she is not kicking all the time. But we're able to do rectal and transabdominal ultrasounds on them. So with the transabdominal, we're able to kind of see some kind of movement or just a little glimpse here and there. As you could probably tell by looking at them, they have such thick skin. So it's a little hard to, you know, get like an accurate little cute little picture of a little baby rhino in there like we do for humans. But nonetheless, you could definitely see it moving around in there.
Remind us, Shalini, how rare is this species of eastern black rhino? I was reading that because of illegal poaching and smuggling, because their horns are so, I guess they're worth more than gold in some cultures, that this species has declined by 98% from 1960 mm-hmm. to the 1990s.
Yeah, unfortunately, after the 1970s, the illegal horn and ivory trade kind of just skyrocketed. plummeting their numbers drastically. So right now it's about 800 in actual wild areas and a little bit more in kind of like preserves in Africa. To have the eastern black rhinos here is pretty amazing too, especially when Tumani was born. You know, we haven't had a baby born in human care in so many years. So to have, you know, little Des Moines, Iowa represent that national and internationally was just, you know, incredible and awesome to be a part of. But even in America, there's a little under 70 institutions that house eastern black rhinos. So we all have like a special treat having them here. And I do want to mention, too, that their horn is made out of keratin, which is the same material as hair and fingernails, so it doesn't have any sort of medicinal value to it at all. And it's just a shame with the poaching situation, how it's just for, you know, almost like a trophy item in some countries when, you know, there's absolutely no use for it. And you have to kind of take an entire animal down for just a little status symbol, which is very upsetting to all of us.
Yeah, it is. It is very, very sad. Will any of the rhinos, so wonderful that the Blank Park Zoo is doing this, but will any of these eastern black rhinos ever, you think, have a chance to live in the wild?
Right now they are, you know, there's about 800 to 1,000 that are able to live in the wild. The biggest thing is going to be to just keep educating the public and just letting them know how, you know, how unnecessary poaching is for these trade, for the horn trade, and then just kind of just being a part of the conservation movement as well. I mean, I'm hoping that zoos and our generation and generations to come will work more toward, you know, saving habitat and these animals as well. But, you know, coming to the zoo and learning as much as you can about them, and, you know, some people don't even know about the poaching crisis and why it's so important for us to be breeding and housing them. I think that's definitely going to be a huge impact on the future of their survival.
Okay, Shalini Babu, animal keeper at the Blank Park Zoo in Des Moines. You'll have a chance to see the new baby in not too long. I think the end of February, right, Shalini?
Yes, that's what we're hoping for.
Wow, after a long time in the, what'd you call it, the cooker?
Yes. It'll be worth it.
Okay, I'm sure it will. Shalini, thanks for your time.
Yeah, no problem.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, we like to go out on music. We like to groove into the weekend. Tony Daner is with us from IPR Studio One, where he's a Tracks Studio One Tracks host. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
I'm fine, and I think we're going to focus in on some newly announced artists for this year's Hinterland Music Festival in early August, right?
Yeah, the big music news of the week here in Iowa. The Hinterland Music Festival announced August 2nd through 4th this year. It's 3 days. We'll get back to that in a bit. But first, we're going to talk about the Friday night headliner. This is kind of the alternative night at Hinterland, and this year, pretty good get for Friday night. It's Hozier, the Irish singer. Had a big album a few years ago and has a new one coming in March. Great, great voice. Really big voice. Reminds me a lot of gospel music. And this new album is going to include this song that I'm really looking forward to hearing that Friday night. Hozier and Almost Sweet Music.
Boy, you are right, Tony. I could listen to that voice all afternoon.
Yeah, that's going to sound incredible at the St. Charles Amphitheater late at night. You know, lightning bugs everywhere. I can't wait. Yeah.
Yeah, but with our outside right now, frozen wasteland.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of cruel that you say that. But all right, let's go on. Female artists, what do we have there? Because there's been comments about a lack of female representation at the past Hinterlands?
Yeah, last year's lineup was not great gender representation. Definitely better this year with a couple of big-name female headliners, including this next artist. Now, you remember I mentioned earlier this year the festival has been expanded to 3 days. Sunday night, they specifically extended so they could bring back Brandi Carlile, who performed at the first ever Hinterland Festival 5 years ago. Since then, she has only gotten bigger and better in name. She's actually up for 6 Grammy Awards. That happens Sunday night. And Brandi Carlile coming back. And hopefully we'll hear this song, It's Harder to Forgive.
I love the songs I hated when I was young, because they take me back where I come from. When every broken heart seemed like the end, when everyone was someone different then. But I can be alone in a crowded world.
Well, Tony, thanks for giving us a little taste of what's to come at the Hinterland Music Festival announced this week. The lineup, August 2nd through the 4th, Tony, and on Studio One, you'll be talking about this and featuring the artists, I'm sure.
Ben. And you also go to iowapublicradio.org. We've got a great preview there, including Mark Simmitt's interview with Sam Summers. Also a Spotify playlist.
All right. Let's go out with a little Brandi Carlile, Harder to Forgive. Tony Daynor, thanks so much. IPR Studio One Tracks host.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Lulu Dewey. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
I have suffered for the peace inside my mind, and some things are better left unsaid, while some things work out.